Okay, so you're listening to KATN LP 106.9 Salida, and I've got a great lineup of guests this evening. It's Rosa Corey and Terry Hall, and they both have come from very active organizations that have a lot to offer for information for the community out there, and I brought them together because I think these two have a lot that complement one another in their activism. I've had them both on the program before, but I'm going to go ahead and let Rosa tell us a little bit about herself, and then we'll let Terry do so, and then we'll just get into the conversation. Rosa?
Great. Well, I'm Rosa Corey, and I'm the executive director of the Post Sustainability Institute, and you can find us on the web. We also have Democrats Against UN Agenda 21.com. And that's a great site with a lot of really good information. And then I have also written a book called Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. I'm a commercial forensic real estate appraiser. My specialty is eminent domain valuation, and I've just retired after 30 years of working primarily with the Department of Transportation in valuing property to be taken for freeways. And while I was engaged in that work, I recognized that there was a planning revolution going on about 10 years ago. And in working through that and finding out what that meant for private property rights, I became involved in the fight against redevelopment. I was elected to a redevelopment project area committee here in the town that I live in, about an hour north of San Francisco. And at first I supported it. But the further I looked into it, I found that it was fraudulent, and I initially alerted the city to that, hoping that they would stop the project, but in fact it became clear that they knew that it was fraudulent and in fact had hired a consulting firm that would actually forward this project regardless of the fact that it was fraudulent. So I fought that together with a group. We created a group, and we sued the city to stop this huge redevelopment project. We lost in Superior Court, and then we went up to the appellate level where we lost again. And during that three-year period, in doing my research on private property rights and redevelopment and the funding mechanism for redevelopment, I discovered United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development. And I have been touring the country, going and speaking to groups about Agenda 21, because awareness is the first step in the resistance, and it is necessary for us all to understand together that this is not a left-right issue. This is an issue that all of us as Americans need to be concerned about and to actively band together and stop. And so I'm really looking forward to talking about this today.
Okay, and Rosa, again, give your websites again, because you had a couple of them, right?
Yes, actually. There are three websites. The first one is postsustainabilityinstitute.org, and that's sort of the that's the 501c4 with it's kind of the clearinghouse. And then we have Democrats Against UN Agenda 21.com, and then our boots on the ground group are the that is an actual group that's fighting here locally in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that is SantaRosaNeighborhoodCoalition.com. And on that site, you'll find what we're doing physically on the ground to fight United Nations Agenda 21. Our flyers are, exactly what we've been up to. And all of this information is available on the web. And then, of course, you can get my book through any of those websites.
Okay, Terry?
Yes, my name is Terry Hall, and I'm the founder and director of Texans Uniting for Reform and Freedom. Our web address is texasturf.org. That's Texas spelled out, and then T-U-R-F.org. And I am a homeschool mom of eight children, and I became an activist on transportation issues back in, 2005 is when we first learned that our Texas Department of Transportation, we call it TxDOT for short, had done a public hearing near my house, and we found out that they were going to come in and slap tolls on all of our existing free lanes going into and out of San Antonio. I live just north of San Antonio, Texas, in the Texas Hill Country. They call it the front porch to the Texas Hill Country. It's very beautiful and scenic, and we love where we live. But if I had known that they were going to come in and take this our only way into and out of San Antonio away from us, I'm sure we wouldn't have put roots down here. But we started, really I first just started by meeting with our Texas Department of Transportation District Office and started asking questions, because I could tell that there was a whole lot of other Texans in the room at this public hearing that were just as mad as I was, that they were going to come in and slap toll on a road that's already been built and paid for. We could see it was a huge tax grab. And lo and behold, I had no idea what kind of can of worms I was getting myself into. And so I just knew, I could tell, like Rosa was saying, that you could tell there was some kind of a development revolution going on. We could see that the way that roads were about to be funded in the state of Texas, and since then, we've seen that it's hitting all 50 states. It's not something unique to Texas. And how we fund our roads is now completely under attack. An affordable, freely accessible public road system funded with gas taxes is now falling by the wayside in favor of toll taxing a mess of our highways, not including existing roads that have already been built and paid for. And it's really across all administrations. Like Rosa's saying, it is not a left and right dynamic. It really is the government elites against we the people when it comes to this transportation policy. So needless to say, we started getting involved in this, going to different TxDOT public hearings, trying to stop them from putting tolls on this road, putting all kinds of, you know, public opposition on the record at these meetings, which was very important for how they do these types of projects. And within a month or so of meeting with the TxDOT officials, and I could tell I was getting nowhere and what they were doing made no sense. I had heard at the first public hearing that I attended that there was already money to fix this road and expand the road and keep it a freeway, and everyone was asking, well, where did that money go? Where did that money go? And when I met with the TxDOT officials, it was very obvious to me that they weren't telling the truth and that they were obfuscating and that they didn't want to give the real information, that they were really well-trained in propaganda and how to try and convince the public and overcome opposition with talking points, and I didn't buy any of it. And so from then on, I'm like, okay, how do we tap into the public opposition on this in a meaningful way to be able to put a stop to what's going on? And within a month of that, there was a huge story that hit the front page of the San Antonio Express News that an unsolicited bid to take over these projects that were in our area of town were going to be taken over by foreign companies. They had put an unsolicited bid on the desk of our highway department and wanted to come in and do something called a public-private partnership. And, of course, everybody had a fit about that. In Texas, we hold state sovereignty and private property rights real sacred in our state, and it didn't sit well with people to hand over, you know, control of our public infrastructure to these foreign entities. And within a few weeks of that, we find out about the Trans-Texas Corridor, and that the same company that was trying to take over our roads in San Antonio was the same company who wanted to build this massive NAFTA superhighway known as the Trans-Texas Corridor. And we have been actively fighting both of those agendas for a very long time in Texas. We've had some successes, like Rosa was talking about. She was able to stop some redevelopment projects. Well, this last session, it took us 6 years, but the legislature meets every 2 years here in Texas. And in 2011 session, we finally got the entire repeal of the Trans-Texas Corridor out of the Texas Transportation Code, which is just a huge victory. I mean, I don't even know how to tell. I'm sure in your audience, Melody, that your audience knows how difficult it is to get even a provision or an ordinance or anything overturned, much less an entire chapter of the Transportation Code repealed. So that was a big deal. And we've had a lot of resistance to these public-private partnerships, and we were able to get a moratorium put on those, and those expired in 2009, so they were no longer able to write those contracts. However, this last session, they did move forward with 15 specific projects could still move forward. And so we're still battling lots of fronts, but it wasn't long before we figured out that this is all tied to Agenda 21. Public-private partnerships are part and parcel of that. And we had a separate bill passed in the legislature last year that now opens the can of worms to public-private partnerships for every other kind of public infrastructure. It didn't apply to roads, but they're trying to do it with city halls and nursing homes and hospitals and schools and, telecommunication lines and ports and pipelines, you name it. Every kind of public infrastructure is going to be put up on the auction block in these public-private partnerships, which we can talk more about later. But that's just a little bit about what we've been doing. And we have sued twice to stop this toll road that got me involved in this whole mess to begin with on U.S. Highway 281 near my house. And after 7 years, just last week, our MPO, which is a Metropolitan Planning Organization, they're set up by the federal government in any area that's got 50,000 people or more has an MPO of local elected officials, and they allocate where your state and federal gas tax monies are allocated for road projects. And they voted to convert all of these existing roads here in San Antonio into toll roads back in July of 2004. And despite having thousands of people turn out to public hearings for 7 years, we got nowhere until last week. Our MPO just voted to return several of those projects back to non-toll projects. So, again, another huge victory for the grassroots. And if we hadn't hung in there and stuck with it, it would have never happened. So that's a little bit about our organization.
Wow.
Well, congratulations, Terry. That's fantastic. Really great work.
Yes.
Thank you. And as you know, it's all because of the grassroots elbow grease. It's the only thing that oftentimes litigation are the two things that we have working for us on these issues.
Rosa, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about your situation when we last did the interview, you were working for an entity that might have had a problem with your activism. Are you still doing that, or have you departed?
No, I've left. My last day of work, or my last day on the books, was March 30th. So I no longer work for the California Department of Transportation, and one of the reasons that I decided to leave that employment after 30 years and a great career, a very interesting career, is, of course, because I, you know, as Terry saw, you know, it's important to be able to criticize the Departments of Transportation because we are seeing a loss of control over our infrastructure through public-private partnerships. What we're seeing is a transfer to a corporatocracy and ultimately a global totalitarian state. And this is the process that it goes, that it moves through. And because we're Americans, and a lot of us, of course, have gone through, especially younger people, have gone through indoctrination, outcome-based education, which is also part of the United Nations Agenda 21 program, we're not able to recognize that we're actually undergoing this process right now of transferring our rights as individuals to the rights of the collective. And, you know, this is the, let me just say what United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development is. It's a plan to inventory and control all resources, both human and natural, and all information and all means of production in the world. It's a global plan, but it's implemented locally. It was the action plan for sustainable development, and it was signed on to by 179 nations in 1972. George H.W. Bush signed the United States up for it. And then the following year, when Clinton took office, he instituted the implementation of Agenda 21 in the United States with the President's Council on Sustainable Development, which was made up of 12 cabinet-level secretaries, captains of industry, including Ken Lay from Enron, and certain environmental groups like the National Resources Defense Council, and the Sierra Club, among others. And so what that did was then they gave a multi-million dollar grant to the American Planning Association to institute United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development in every city and town and state in the entire United States. And that's what I recognized as a planning revolution, because by 2002, the American Planning Association's book, which is called Growing Smart, a legislative guidebook with planning and the management of change, with model statutes for planning and the management of change. That book was in every single university, college, and planning department in the United States by 2002. And that is what we're seeing is when you see smart growth in your town, which is high-density urban development, and you see that it's no longer viable for you to live out in suburban and rural areas, where you're seeing that your ability to actually function out in a rural area is becoming more and more difficult because your wells are being monitored, your land use is being restricted, more and more land is being identified as being habitat. So this is all part of Agenda 21, and it has been instated in the United States. And the element of it that of course we're seeing is primarily through land use, but then we're also seeing it in our collapse of our educational system and the increase of domestic surveillance. This is all part of the same plan.
So there's a tie-in, if I understand it correctly, and I don't remember where I heard this from, but there's these transportation monies tie into some of these projects, right, that are outside, that would seemingly outside of the of highways, or did I misinterpret something I heard?
Well, almost 40, do you want to go for that? I would say that 40%, I believe, is what we're up to now, of the federal highway money is going to mass transit. And they're trying to take more and more of our road taxes and apply them to forms of mass transit, whether it's rail or buses or light rail or what have you, to try and divert that money away from road capacity.
Okay.
Or bus lanes. These are going for bike lanes as well in
the city. Yes, that's complete streets policy, and we've been fighting that desperately here in Texas. Remember, Texas is supposed to be a conservative, states' rights, constitutional loving state that's supposed to be dominated by conservative legislators. And in our legislature, we had to fight tooth and nail last session to put the kibosh on a bill that was going to mandate complete streets. Now, complete streets, to give your audience an idea of what that is, I'm sure that Rosa knows what it is, but basically what it does is it mandates that a certain amount, at least that's how the bill was written here in Texas, that a certain amount of road money has to go to make streets what they call complete. That means that it's accessible to all modes of transportation, whether it's dedicated bus lanes, dedicated bike lanes, hike and bike trails, you name it, they're going to use your road money to do anything except expand the capacity on your roads. It's a war on autos. It's totally designed to make it so expensive to own and operate a vehicle that you will be forced out of your car and the, evil internal combustion engine or what have you that we've heard so much of, and force you into some form of mass transit. And just like Rosa was saying, that's why it's getting harder and harder to live in the suburbs and in rural America, because they're going to make it so that you can't afford to access what you need to from the big cities and get out to your property and still have an existence because of whether it's land use restriction, sealing up your water rights or pumping rights, or just physically the cost of getting your goods to market will be so high that it's going to put local farms out of operation.
Okay, now one of the things that I don't know if either one of you are aware of the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but there's also a very good documentary on YouTube, and I don't have the name of it right at the moment, but it gets into the whole act that, okay, the predicament we're in on transportation didn't start, just with the advent of the car. I mean, they had good public transportation systems in certain areas, and they purposely got rid of the setup they had so that they could develop the car. And these guys, predict these things or plan these things way in advance. So it's like they wanted to tear down something they already had to build up for something they were going to do in the future after they developed, the sprawl that they created with the automobile and the highway system. So I find it hard to believe that they would have shot themselves in the foot without having some of this, knowing that they were going to plan this in the future. Because does anybody know how old the early planning of Agenda 21 maybe was developed before they gave it that name or really implemented it? Wasn't it back in the 70s?
The Trilateral Commission, it really started back right before Nixon, and then after that, Carter. And this Trilateral Commission was really all about bringing together the three countries that, you probably have heard about the North American Union.
Right.
And the idea of economically and, financially and a whole lot of other ways, integrating the three countries. And the Trilateral Commission was, the early stages of the implementation of Agenda 21, but under a different type, a different name. And, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is another way that they do this whole globalist strategy. And that's what Agenda 21 is. It's just the blueprint for global government, and that's what the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations laid the groundwork for long before we ever saw Agenda 21 with that official name and title put to it.
Okay, now, Rosa, you've been with the Department of Transportation, you said, for 30 years. So you had to have been somewhat aware of how because California is supposed to have had a good public transportation system, back in the 40s and 50s, right? Or were you aware of that?
Well, obviously road production, road construction, departments of transportation initially were just, huge constructors of roads. And now there's been a transition from providing transportation from coast to coast to, in fact, as Terry said, forwarding a globalist ideology. When you look at the Trans-Texas Corridor, for instance, that's supposed to, connect Mexico and the United States and Canada through essentially a land-based sea lane, a shipping lane, which would remain, it's not for the purpose of alleviating congestion in the states or countries that it's going through.
Right.
Exactly. It's a land-based shipping lane so that you would you can't, when it was going through Texas, I think, there were only like five ramps through the entire state.
That's right.
And it was, it's basically designed to completely close off. It was going to split the state in half. And, this is not what your transportation system was initially planned to do. And so what we're seeing, especially with, we're talking about integration of nations. We're talking about an actual loss of boundaries. And, in fact, this is the design. There is no president who has sat in office and there will be no one who moves into that position who is not supporting this plan. And what you're seeing is an actual erasure of boundaries, of municipal boundaries. You're seeing a loss of your city, county, state, and ultimately federal boundaries through regionalization, through every element of our government is the lines are being blurred through regionalization, through public-private partnerships, where you have a corporatocracy that's essentially taking over governance. And you have the illusion of public buy-in. Of course, you're being invited to these visioning meetings where you go and vision on someone else's property who's probably not at the meeting. But what you're actually privy to is total indoctrination of the people of not just our country but of the world. And so we're having ourselves invited into these visioning meetings where we're actually being Delphi'd with a Rand Corporation mind control technique that convinces us that these plans are our idea, but in fact we're actually being indoctrinated and brainwashed. And this is a very, very effective plan. It's actually, Melody, when you say, but how come, you know, it looks like this, and don't they even realize what they're doing, and how could they shoot themselves in the foot? The plan is to collapse our economy. You can't have a strong United States economy and not have us completely collapse. It's to sink our economy, exhaust our military, diagnose a huge portion of our population with mental illness, cripple our transportation system with these high-cost trains to nowhere, and totally indoctrinate us with, you know, with a neurotic belief that we're destroying the planet just simply by living. This is the plan.
Well said.
I agree, and I would love to bring up some of the property rights aspects, Rosa and Melody, because you touched on it, Rosa, when you talked about public-private partnerships, and I think it's so interesting that you worked for your DOT out there and were actually doing the appraisals, basically, for the value of the land that was going to be condemned by eminent domain. And that's really another aspect to this, aside from the threat to freedom to travel, aside from the sale of our infrastructure and the sovereignty of our infrastructure being put in the hands of foreign private corporations. There's also the property rights aspect to this, which also didn't sit well with most Texans, as you can imagine, and most anybody in the public who's aware of this. And that is what public-private partnerships do. They will completely erase private property rights in this country if they fulfill this plan. And, you know, we all became aware of just how evil the plan was when the Kelo case happened in, I believe it was 2006, when, of course, the city of New London versus Suzette Kelo, where they came in and decided that the government can take your land simply for economic development purposes, that if they can get a higher tax base from a commercial property than they can from your residential property, then they can condemn your land forcibly against your will, pay you nothing for it, and hand it over to another private entity for private gain simply because they want to make more money from your land. And so that really eroded and, if not completely erased, what vestige of private property we had left in this country. And another way that they're doing this is through these cleverly worded public-private partnerships. You know, there's a whole group of folks that have no problem with a completely private road, and that would be one where the private company comes in and decides that they can build a competing road with some of the public roads that we drive on because they see that there's congestion on the public road, and they come in and give the landowner a price they're willing to sell for, and they acquire the land, and they pay themselves back through a toll. And that involves no eminent domain. It involves no public money, no land use, you know, abuses, hopefully. And that could be a truly privatized road. However, that's not what's happening. These are called public-private partnerships for a reason. It's the commingling of government with the private entities. And that's a great name that you called it, Rosa's corporatocracy. That's exactly what we're doing. This is eminent domain abuse on a scale we've never seen for roads before. We've all understood that eminent domain is necessary in some cases to build a road, you know, in the name of the public good. And so the government was only supposed to use it very sparingly to perhaps get the last few holdouts on a project to be able to, you know, build a roadway. Well, now we're seeing eminent domain being used in the name of a public use, but still in the end, it gets handed over to one of these private, usually foreign corporations in a public-private partnership, and there's several reasons why they want the public or and or the government involved in this. They need them for three or four different things. Let me see if it's three or four. I'll name them off here. The first one is they want to come after our public subsidies. Very few of these projects are actually toll viable. That means that they already know up front that there's not enough forecasted traffic to take that road to actually pay for the cost of building and maintaining that road. So they want to kind of, instead of, you know, you and I, if we were private investors, we'd say, well, it's not toll viable, so we're not going to build that one. Let's move on to the next project. But that's not what they're doing. They just say, oh, okay, well, let's say it's a $400 million project, and the private toll investors look at it and say, well, it's only really, you can only pay for half of that project with the toll revenue, so it's $200 million that we'll put in private toll revenue bonds. You're going to have to come up with another $200 million if you want to build this $400 million project, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're handing them over gobs of either gas tax money, whether it's state or federal gas taxes, and now we have this huge pot of corporate welfare fund money called the TIFIA loan program, which is the Federal Transportation Innovative Finance and Infrastructure Act, I believe is what CFIA stands for. And that's a huge slush fund for these public-private partnerships to come after our public money in order to fund what ultimately becomes a privatized toll road. And so they want our public money to subsidize their losses. The second thing they need us for is eminent domain, of course, because they don't want to pay you a market price for your land. They want to pay you dirt for it, and they can get a higher profit when they do so, and they don't want to have to deal with all the messy paperwork and challenges in court or whatever all they have to deal with. So they want to have the state come in and condemn people's property for them. So they want the eminent domain. The other thing they want is the non-compete. And that's exactly the kinds of provisions in these contracts that we have fought from day one. This means that your highway department is bound by these private contracts that they sign, that they cannot build or expand any competing free roads within a certain mile radius of this privatized foreign-owned toll road. So it guarantees congestion on your free lane for, and these are very long-term leases, so it's in Texas, it's minimum 52 years. Of course, with the Indiana Toll Road Public-Private Partnership, it was a 75-year lease. And on the Chicago Skyway deal, that was a 99-year lease. And by the way, the same two companies that bought up the Indiana Toll Road and doubled the toll rates already, and they're already teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, which guess who they're going to come after to bail them out? You and I, the taxpayer, will bail that out. But the same two companies also bought the Chicago Skyway, which is Cintra and Macquarie, Spain-based Cintra and Australian-based company Macquarie, are the exact same companies that were trying to do the Trans-Texas Corridor here in the state of Texas. And of the three public-private partnerships that got away, so to speak, before our moratorium got put in place, and two of them were exceptions that were in the moratorium bill, so they grandfathered these in. But of these three projects, every single one of them went to Cintra, the same company. Now, what does this tell you about what is happening to our infrastructure in our country? It is going to be wholly owned subsidiary of a Spanish firm that doesn't give a flip about Americans or how much it costs you to get to work or whether or not you have the ability to pay what it's going to take for you to get to your place of employment or even just for grandma's house. You know, they don't care. And what we're finding is that the fourth thing they want government for is the toll collection and enforcement piece. If they don't have the big gun power of being able to take away your car registration or your driver's license or some other really big element that they can do to make your life miserable, if you don't pay what they say you owe them, then, of course, they'd never be able to get and collect their toll money. Because basically they're charging what amounts to usury in order to use these roads. We see the toll rates on a public toll road go from anywhere from 12 to maybe 25 cents a mile. Onto these privatized public-private partnership toll roads, we see 75 cents a mile to get around. And they know that there's no way people are going to pay that, and there's lots of toll violations happening. And the way that they get you is they have the government power do the collection and enforcement for them. So they really do have the power to take away your ability to make a living and to get to and from work if you don't pay up their extortion money.
Okay, now, Terry, when you said, because I thought I understood somewhere, if it wasn't just now, but in the past that you stated that, okay, so there's nothing to prevent them from caring whether they go bankrupt because isn't the government guaranteeing they're going to get their money no matter what? Did I understand that correctly? Whether the tolls were there or not?
The way that this is, there are not, let's see, the first contract that I've been able to get access to, because they keep these contracts secret from the public. That's another thing that tells you that what they're doing is not on the up and up, and they're not being transparent, and they hide all the details until after the contract is signed. Now, I haven't seen anything that necessarily has the taxpayer guarantee the losses on this thing, but the way they do it is on the front end. So it's through the subsidies on the front end where they say, look, we know this thing's only toll viable up to maybe 50% of the cost, so you need to come in with the other 50% or else we'll never be able to make this thing fly economically. So they kind of bail it out already with the subsidy on the front end. But we also have a pattern that shows if these things go belly up, it's going to be the taxpayer that's on the hook for the losses. For instance, in California, where Rosa's had, it's been the San Diego area. There was another one of these public-private partnerships, one of the first ones to get a TIFIA loan, that federal loan program I told you about that's a big corporate slush fund, of subsidies for these guys. And the very first toll road to get that TIFIA loan was the South Bay Expressway out there in San Diego. And within 3 years, the road went bankrupt. And they restructured it, and they have continued to keep the road open. But now it's been taken over by, I want to say it was the Orange County Council of Governments or something. It wasn't even their toll authority there. I'm not sure, but I remember reading that it had something to do with their Council of Governments. So some governmental entity took over that road, and the taxpayers had to write down nearly $80 million of the $217-odd million federal loan that was given to it. So basically, even though we didn't bail it out by handing them more money, we basically are never going to get that $80 million back. And I believe that that road was also built with some public money aside from the TIFIA loan. So they get the money from the taxpayer, whether you want to call it a bailout and the way it's actually happening is, I guess, up for debate. But they do it through the public subsidies, through writing down the loans and the bankruptcy. And I feel like we are creating an infrastructure bubble in this country where somewhere down the road at the end of the day, when they get enough of these contracts signed and it affects enough of our infrastructure countrywide, not just state-by-state level, but I mean, you know, a good portion of our infrastructure is going to fall into the hands of these corporatocracies, they're going to come after us for a huge, massive bailout like we saw with TARP, where there was this, you know, huge bailout of the banks and the insurance, the AIG, of course, insurance, and the subprime mortgages caused a, what, almost $1 trillion bailout by the U.S. taxpayer. Well, that's what's going to start happening because it's going to be deemed too big to fail, and it would not surprise me one bit if we see a huge bailout coming because they're not going to let all of these roads fall into bankruptcy. And what are they going to do? What, hand them back to a bank to operate? I mean, how's that going to work, you know? So I think if they're ultimately setting it up, knowing full well, I mean, if you look at the traffic and revenue studies for these toll roads, they already know there's not enough traffic that's ever going to come close to paying off the cost of building this infrastructure. And so that's why, the Goldman Sachs and the J.P. Morgans and the Citigroup, they all get their money on the front end. And then they get it again and again when they refi these things over and over again. And at the end of the day, they know that the U.S. government isn't going to let it go belly up and that they'll be able to come get some big bailout like the banks did with TARP because it'll be deemed too big to fail. So I think that's coming. We've already seen it happen in San Diego. So
in a way, it's almost bigger than that because when you look at what is known as the Club of Paris, which is the way that the G8 and G20 structure their debt, if you look at it in terms of how they're planning to collect that debt, what they have is debt swaps, and they do debt for nature swaps, debt for infrastructure swaps, and so we'll have, you know, for instance, when we have created this massive amount of debt, public debt, that we are not able to service, as you said, and of course that, you know, when we're talking about a global banking structure, at least during the, 1800s, there was that sense of noblesse oblige, which was, that the robber barons were actually endowing universities in the United States or whatever country they were in with that sense that they had some responsibility in some way to their native country. But now, because of, it's through globalism, that is completely gone by the wayside. So what we have now is debt for nature swaps. And I think that that is part of why people are being removed out of the rural and suburban areas, ostensibly to protect the natural environment out there. But when we have indebted ourselves so enormously to other countries that are, basically either taking over parts of our essential infrastructure or taking over our natural resources, then we, essentially you have to ask yourself, what does it mean to be an American? Then you truly are a citizen of the world because you have lost your sovereignty over your nation. So, and one thing I want to say about having worked for the Department of Transportation for such a long time is in California, Now, I have done some studies of other states, but the California Department of Transportation pays the highest price that the market will pay on your property. So when I appraise a shopping center or an office building or a sand and gravel quarry or something like that, what I'm looking at is the highest price that would be paid to you on the open market. And so when you're acquired by eminent domain, the only issue there is how much money you're going to get. And when I, you know, so this is not like, you know, I know some states are not strong in that. They, as far as I'm concerned, if the state can't afford to acquire the property, they should not be attempting to do that. And I have been part of projects where I said, you know what, you can't afford this, and the project died because there wasn't enough money for it. So I think that that really needs to be made clear. What we're seeing, though, with redevelopment projects, or in some states they're called urban renewal, is that, you know, taking it back from, you know, from transportation and bringing it down to land use in terms of residential or commercial land use, which you're seeing in cities, you're seeing the same thing that Terry's talking about with subsidies that are coming from your transportation and property tax dollars to fund individual projects that are for-profit projects that are identified as being in some way for the public good. So this might be, for instance, a high-density urban development project that is mixed use. And you'll see these across the United States in the center of no matter what size town you're in. Ground floor retail built right to the edge of the sidewalk, 12 feet high. Above that, you know, 12-foot high ceilings. And above that, two or more stories of residential condos or apartments. Around the back in an alley, you'll have parking for one or less cars per unit. This is put on so-called transportation lines, and that's complete streets. Those transportation projects may never happen. They may be high-speed trains that are never actually going to be put in place. You'll be penalized for having a private vehicle in those areas. Those, and by that I mean there'll be vehicle miles travel taxes. There will be charges for parking that are extremely high in the city. You'll be charged to come into the center of cities or go out of them. And those will be tolls as well. So what we're seeing is actual subsidizing of private developers in terms of the infrastructure and actual construction of buildings for the this is the preferred design model for Agenda 21 because it packs you into a building where you can be observed, where you can be surveilled, controlled, managed. That's not so easy to do when you're out there in the urban, in the suburban and rural areas. But taking control of your water use out there in the rural areas, your roads. I live in a it's a rural county. We have 1,384 miles of rural roads here. Our county supervisors announced that they will not be paving more than 150 miles of those county roads in the future. They will be pulverizing them to gravel. And people who are out in those rural areas who have agricultural properties that need to bring their goods to market, or people who simply live out there and want to, you know, just get in and out of their property, will no longer be able to do that. And what that means is a loss in property value. And ultimately, what that also means is a loss of people paying property taxes. And that also means that there's less money for infrastructure, less money for your roads, your schools, your light, your, you know, your lights, your police and fire. And when you have redevelopment areas in the cities, that money, the tax money, is property tax money, is going to service that bond debt. It is not going to pay for your services. So you have this perpetual creation of blight, of supposed blight, where you've transferred private property ownership to public ownership, and then you take it off of the tax rolls, and then you have no support for your property, for your services. And we're seeing that all over the United States, and this is tremendously impactful to all of our services. It's part of the plan.
Rosa, it's funny that you bring that up.
because with the Trans-Texas Corridor, that was actually one of the arguments that some of the opponents were making in some other coalition of groups that we had together on that. And that was that they were going to take so much land off of these smaller county tax rolls by building this massive superhighway that was going to be 4 football fields wide, 1,200 feet, when a normal-sized interstate is only about 400 feet wide, fully built out. This was going to be 3 times the size of an interstate, 4 football fields wide. And when you take that kind of land off of the tax rolls, they were literally going to bankrupt some of these cities and counties and their ability to even provide their public schools and, you know, education and what have you. And, it, of course, like you mentioned before, it was going to bisect whole communities where, because the private developer was only required to build an exit where it currently intersected state or federal highways, that's why they could have literally almost 700 or 800 mile road from one end of Texas to the other and only have 5 exits. Well, that, of course, was going to completely bisect somebody's property. If you have this thing coming through your property and bisecting it in two, you would literally not be able to get your cattle from one side to the other because there would be no overpass or underpass for you to drive them through. Same thing with school. You wouldn't be able to get your school kids from one side of this road to the other to get to school because there were no overpasses or underpasses for them to be able to traverse this massive footprint of a road. And so that taking all that property off of the county and city tax rolls is what finally woke up some of the local governmental entities to help work with the citizens to stop this crazy project. So sometimes you can actually use that as a means, if we're talking about grassroots activism and how you stop this nonsense. Educating is obviously the first step. But if you want to know how to stop it, sometimes that will help wake up some of your local governmental entities to work with you to stop them, because it really does put their ability to continue this public services at risk and in jeopardy.
Are either one of you?
I've seen that actually. I've seen that here because, of course, regionalization is all across the United States. That is the plan, is to erase your local boundaries and to create these unelected boards and commissions that are actually dictating to your local entities. And what we're seeing here with One Bay Area, which is a plan that is essentially repeated all across the United States and, in fact, the world. In fact, you'll see it in your area. It's called Visioning Your Town or Your Town 2050
yes.
or 2040 or
mm-hmm.
2025.
They call it Envision 2020.
Exactly.
Yes.
Uh-huh. There you go. It's all the same plan. It's the exact same plan all over. They just changed the names. In fact, I looked at the Hanoi Center Regional Plan recently, and it's the same as the One Bay Area Plan, as the 9 counties, One Vision of Tennessee, of the 4 states, One Vision. You know, they're all the same. So what you see with these plans is actually they erase and take away the power of the local municipalities, and they divert your property tax, actually your transportation tax funds, as you said, Terry. What they're doing is making it so that all of that funding has to go to actually support this supposed incredible boom of population that they're predicting by 2050. If people go to America2050.org, you'll see there are the 11 mega regions of the United States that actually include part of Mexico and Canada. And these plans are in effect right now. The plan, in fact, when you see high-speed rail, this is the number one building block for mega regions, which will replace, they're the interim step that replaces states and ultimately will erase the federal boundaries. So, for instance, you've got that Texas Triangle that is a mega region.
Yeah.
In the Pacific Northwest, it's Cascadia. In the Southwest, it's called the Southern California mega region. And these are essentially power centers for populations. And these are designed so that people will be removed from the rural and suburban areas and packed ultimately into the city centers, these hugely dense vertical sprawl locations where we can then be controlled and monitored. And our money is going for that now, and this is the plan.
Well, Terry,
I
just wanted to say, are you guys familiar with utility corridors?
Ties into what they were trying to do with the Trans-Texas Corridor, because that was one of the things that made it so different from a normal interstate or other highway, is that they wanted it to be multimodal. It was supposed to include auto lanes, truck lanes, and then, of course, they were going to have commuter rail, freight rail, telecommunication lines, pipelines, utilities of all sorts, all in the right-of-way of this 1,200-foot-wide corridor.
Okay.
So I bet it ties in to somewhat of what they were trying to, you know, throw into this Trans-Texas Corridor concept. It was also going to be a utility corridor, and we also felt like it was also a scheme to move water around the state. As you probably have all heard, we had basically what I would call a 100-year drought last year in Texas, and it was devastating to the cattle ranchers and the farming industry here, and just in a lot of ways to all Texans. And one of the things we've seen is a huge water wars going on, and like you said, in some of these land swaps and things we've seen, we've also seen private developers who are now, because there's so many rural farms that are so in arrears with their taxes because they're having such a hard time making a living off their land, and of course they tax, by acre, and when you own lots and lots of acres, even though you're not making a lot of money on those acres, if you're doing cattle ranching or farming, you don't make as much money on them as you would if it was a massive hotel or big development, commercial property. They still have to pay quite a hefty tax bill for these properties, and we have actually have a developer here who's been trying to offer farmers that they will pay your tax bill and get you up to date with your taxes in exchange for your water rights to your property. And I'm going, and so you talk about swaps, right? And, of course, they're desperate because they know the government has the power to ultimately take their land from them. So to them, this seems like, okay, it's this or I lose it all together. Well, before long, they're going to lose it all together because everybody knows you're not going to be able to do farming or cattle ranching very long without the water supply to do it. So the Trans-Texas Corridor was also another clever way to move water around the state because now the state is going to own so much land, and that's why it was called a land grab. When it was going to take 580,000 acres of private property and make them this public-private partnership, commingling, you know, road system, this multimodal utility and everything else corridor, you could see why it was such an insidious plan and why Texans rose up to stop it.
You have that in place, and then you have these land trusts, conservation easements, military.
Yes, yes.
There's one way after another that they're coming in and taking the land. So
absolutely. And the other thing I wanted to mention briefly.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that that's something that it's really necessary to know about United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development is that what's identified as being unsustainable, and that is single-family residences, appliances, air conditioning, meat eating, dams, reservoirs, farming, traditional farming with tillage because it releases greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, supposedly. And one of the things that we're seeing is control of water. This is, you were saying, Terry, this is very, very powerful now. And this is one of the things when I'm talking about debt for nature, and this is really a vital thing to know about, is that, we're talking about, of course, we're talking about how this impacts all of us as individuals. But, when we're talking about the transfer of our water rights, not just to our public entities and not just to, our federal entity, but to a foreign entity that is then going to control our water, then, if you don't have access to your most basic natural resource, then you have lost your ability to run your own life. And I think this is one of the most vital things to know is that with Debt for Nature, which is not something that I made up, it's if you go to it's called Club de Paris, which is clubdeparis.org, and look at that. This is actually what the creditor and debtor nations use to determine what you're going to give as collateral when you're a debtor nation.
Okay, so then that means like your wilderness areas and these various national parks or monuments or whatever can be utilized in a collateral debt exchange.
Yes, that's right, and way more than that. In fact, there are ways to actually give your own currency. And now I'm not talking about handing over cash, but I'm talking about control of your currency. I'm talking about control of your industry. And, you know, I think what we're seeing here is a transfer of our power and our rights, because when you can, when you identify, when the United Nations and through their, and through agreement Agenda 21, our own country, identifies dams and reservoirs as a threat to the planet, then you have, you know, what is that? That is water collection and water use. And so when that is considered to be, you know, something that is dangerous to the planet because it, you know, it doesn't allow just sort of the natural return to the planet as it was before humans were here, when you see that as a threat to the planet through greenhouse gas emissions, then what you're seeing is that it's easy to get you off of that land, and then you don't know what's going on that land. If you can't cross Texas because of the Trans-Texas Corridor, if you can't cross through the entire United States because you don't own those roads are not just transportation. Part of that, the federal highway system is actually part of our national security. Those roads are there primarily to move the military. That's why those roads are, the federal roads are in place. And if we lose control of our roads like this, we have lost control of our nation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what we see here, Rosa, when we bring up those kinds of objections in legislative committees when we're trying to kill a bill, for instance, and tell them why we cannot, you know, we cannot afford public-private partnerships, not only with the financial side, but because of state sovereignty and sovereignty over our infrastructure and those kinds of arguments, they inevitably tell us, oh, and we bring up the military thing, and, of course, Eisenhower, their whole reason why he decided to put so much federal money into a federal highway system was precisely so that we could move our military from one part of the country to another. After he had been, of course, in war himself and knew exactly the importance of this, if we take that military mobility away, then it is a huge problem for national security. Well, what they tell us is, oh, we have an arrangement so that the military can use the roads for free. And so they make exceptions. They carve out exceptions to try and take away one objection you have after another so that by then you only have, oh, maybe just a little handful left, and we can live with all those or get around those. And so that's how they pat themselves on the back and make it sound like it's all fine and dandy to continue to pass this kind of legislation. Well, one thing I wanted to mention to you, because you asked about the bailouts before and where the taxpayers secure the private entity's debt, there was that other bill that passed. It was SB 1048 in the 2011 session. It's the same exact session that we got the repeal of the Trans-Texas Corridor and managed to keep them from reauthorizing public-private partnerships other than a handful that they went ahead and did. But so we had all these victories on one side, but they thought we wouldn't notice. They put it through a different committee. They didn't put it through the Transportation Committee. They put it through the Economic Development and Small Business Committee. Mm-hmm. And in this bill, and we caught it, of course, and we opposed it, and we, you know, did everything we could to stop this bill. But I'm telling you what, those special interests had this thing in the bag before the session ever started.
Oh, yeah.
And literally the Speaker of the House and the Lieutenant Governor who runs the Senate had already hand-selected their committee chairs to be the author of this bill. You can never stop a bill that's being done by a committee chair, just about, because nobody on that committee is going to vote against the committee chair, because then their bills won't pass the committee. And so they already have this thing in the bag. Well, that's the one that spread the public-private partnerships to every other kind of infrastructure aside from roads, because they knew we already had the grassroots opposition in place to stop it for roads. But they thought no one was going to look if they did it everywhere else. And, of course, we ran in to stop it. But I'll tell you what. In the language of that bill and in committee when we were bringing up our objections to this, one of the things they had in there was that they can get loans for these public-private partnership deals. Let's say it's to develop a complex, very similar to what you described with these mixed-use complexes. And what they do now is they say, well, we're a city and we just can't afford to build a new city hall. So we're going to do it with a public-private partnership. And so we're going to get all this land for basically what's going to become a glorified shopping mall around the city hall. So they're going to take far more land than they actually need for the city hall itself, but they're going to, because that's their excuse for, well, we can't afford it, so we're going to give them all this extra land, and then they get the development rights to that property, and they pay themselves back for having built that free city hall, quote-unquote free. We know it has a cost, and this is the cost. They get to charge lease or concession fees, or even sometimes they call them tolls, depending on what kind of infrastructure it is, in order to get paid back for their investment. Well,
so
there's
are
a
those...
city here in Texas called Bee Caves, and that's Bee Cave, Texas, and it's just outside Austin. And this is what they used as the big poster child of why this was such a great, you know, bill, and why we should do this, because it helps cash-strapped governments. Haven't we heard that term a million times in the last 2 or 3 years? It helps cash-strapped governments get these things built without raising taxes. Well, they do it at the expense of property rights. And the other thing we saw in this bill was they can get loans of taxpayer money from state infrastructure banks. And we have one here in Texas, and you probably heard rumblings of it just about a year or two ago, maybe 18 months ago now, where Senator John Kerry and a Texas Senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison, had put forward a bill, an independent standalone bill that they're trying to tack on to the federal highway bill, by the way, that would allow a federal infrastructure bank, and it's very similar to the way the TIFIA loan program turned out to be, where it's just a taxpayer slush fund to subsidize the losses on these public-private partnership deals. So not only could they get a loan of taxpayer money to build the crazy project, I thought the whole reason for doing this was we didn't have the money, and then yet we still subsidize it. Well, then the second thing that was in there that was absolutely horrible is that they also had the taxpayer secure the private entity's debt on the deal. And even on the road project contracts, we've seen it where they...
What?
Yes, and they have even on the roads now, they have sections in them where, in essence, they're guaranteeing the profits. It's not like there's a bailout amount or anything, but they have it so that they can never lose money on the deal. So
okay,
that if the state ever wants to buy back the asset, they have to make sure that they always cover the private entity's debt load in order to do that. And so at the end of the day, there is no risk whatsoever to these private corporations who come in and do this, because they either get the taxpayer money on the front end, or they get profit guarantees, or that they will always have their debt covered on the back end. And at the end of the day, they're taking tons of land from private property and landowners in order to build these public works projects and become a glorified shopping mall surrounding our public assets. And it's horrible as how it's eroding private property rights and raiding the public treasury.
Okay, now, are you familiar with anything called a 6320? Does that sound familiar to you at all? Okay. Well,
no.
What about enterprise zones? Yeah, zones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Enterprise zones.
Are you talking about the tax increment finance zones? Is that the idea? Because we have a lot of those in Texas, and they're trying to do them as transportation reinvestment zones as well. And what those do is they basically have a local city or county designate an area of town that they deem underdeveloped. Here we go again with economic development and blight. The government can call it literally anything. And they can designate it as a transportation reinvestment zone, and then they take an increment from property tax in that zone and apply it to pay for a transportation project. But what it's really about is building a highway to benefit private developers who want to develop an area, and of course they do it all in the name of economic development. So I don't know if that's the same thing as you're talking about.
No, Rosa, what were you going to say?
Well, what Terry's talking about is a tax increment financing project, which is a TIF.
That's right.
And those are, you'll see that as redevelopment as well, or, you know, it's transportation projects or also can be funded that way. But what an enterprise zone is actually a way to provide, it actually creates almost an island of that is outside of the jurisdiction of the local municipality and can be financed through a number of means. Mainly, you'll find federal financing there, where they're doing it in order to encourage industry. But often you'll find that your industry it's not based in the United States. You'll have industry that comes from other countries that uses subsidies there. That has, for each individual that is employed, the government pays a certain amount of money to the whoever it is who's developing this industry there. And they don't have to pay sales taxes. They don't have to pay business taxes. They're essentially an island. And
like a free trade zone? Like those free,
beg your pardon?
Like a free trade zone?
It is like that. And actually you'll find that they may actually bring workers in who are not from the United States, who are transferred
right.
from other countries. And so, and this is something that is, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, the erasure of our national boundaries and our local boundaries and our sovereignty. And not only that, but to, you know, heap, misery on us, we're paying for it. So when we find that we're, you know, that the services that we have come to expect living in our suburban areas or, even our city centers, we're no longer able, you know, they're telling us that they have to turn our street lights out. And yet they're doing no non-recourse loans for developers of shopping centers
That's
and
right.
high-density urban development.
It's a special interest.
These are
absolutely, and that's
projects.
The thing when you take here again we have the private property rights issue when they're going to take the land in the name of a public use, i.e., for a city hall, and yet they take when they only need 5 acres. They take 25 acres and give all that extra land to a private developer for private gain.
You could do that with
it's wrapped up in a different color bow.
You know, that's against the law in California, and I don't know what's the matter with y'all, but
I'm telling you what.
You know, and this has been a real education for me because, as I said, I'm going all across the United States, and, of course, every single place I go, I have to research because I can't just show up there and give my same rap every time. So I've, you know, been researching all over the United States to find out how, you know, all of this stuff works in the individual municipalities. And I'm shocked to see that in some states, the state can acquire property that is not necessary for the project, actually surplus to the project, acquired under eminent
That's
domain.
Right.
And then hand it off to a private individual for a private gain. And this is something that's not permitted in California in the transportation sector. We, you know, if you're going to buy right-of-way for a freeway, that has to be exactly for the width of the freeway and no more.
What
and
about?
But does that apply, though, Rosa, for these other types of public works projects? Because I do believe that's the case for roads here, although when you look at a public-private partnership model, one of the things in the Trans-Texas Corridor that also created so much public blowback was the fact that they were taking far more land than they needed for the actual transportation project. So, for instance, they only needed, I mean, even if they wanted, 600 feet to account for all the extra modes in that corridor, there's no way that they needed a full 1,200 feet. Well, the reason why is because they get the concession rights. They get the exclusive ability to pick the restaurants,
right.
hotels, all the shopping centers that are in this private revenue generating, they basically capture people on this toll road. They never have to get off. And the state of Texas, of course, they decided that they didn't want to let all that revenue jump away. So they do a revenue sharing agreement with the private entity and grant them a state sanctioned monopoly. They get to control, the private entity controls the tax rate. But the government gets to raid the till along with the private entities. So,
I'm not seeing that here, but what I am seeing is on high-speed rail, or we don't, of course, have high-speed rail, but on rail systems, on rail projects that are transportation projects, What happens is, for instance, you have the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, which will acquire property to do a big station, and then they'll determine, and that they use the power of eminent domain, and then they determine that, well, there's, you know, now there's area there that they don't need, and so now they're going to develop high-density housing there because they're right on a transit station. This is called a transit village. You know, you thought you lived in a city, but no, now it's going to be a transit village, and that means that, you know, the only mode of transportation you're going to have will be that train. So I see that as being, you know, an abuse of eminent domain, because in fact, then that is that concession then is sold to a private developer who uses that land, either gets the land for free or gets the infrastructure for free, and then might actually do a project with whatever the agency is, where they do some profit sharing. So what happens then is that, besides all of our subsidies and besides the restrictions on our usage of our own land that is public land, then you're actually having, you'll see these affordable housing developments that don't pay property tax. I don't know if you know that, but an affordable housing development, which might be developed by Enterprise Community Development or LISC, these are huge corporations across the United States that have like $11 billion in leverage and have developed something like 280,000 units of affordable housing. The reason you're seeing so much affordable housing is that it's so heavily subsidized, and then after it's constructed, it does not pay property tax. They use a tremendous amount of services, police and fire, schools, roads, et cetera, and they don't pay taxes on that. And so when you have property that's been developed in that way and it's a drain on your general fund, if that land is also located in a redevelopment area, then you have had your property taxes effectively diverted into the hands of bond brokers and developers. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have, for 30 to 45 years, you have no access to that money, and your general funds are starved. And this is the way that you sink an economy.
Okay, now what?
This is the transfer.
And that's exactly what we tried. I don't think I mentioned this yet, but last November, in the years that our legislature meets, there's always a constitutional amendment election. They are done at the end of May. And then November of that same year, all of the constitutional amendments that the legislature passed come before the Texas voters. We don't have statewide initiative referendum here, so we the people can't put anything on the ballot ourselves. So when I say propositions are voted on, it's all done by the legislature. And I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Texas has one of the most amended state constitutions of any state in the union. They literally amend it every 2 years. And, of course, we've been trying to stop that train wreck for a while now, because really what we find is it's very low turnout, off-year elections. Only those special interests who are going to get access to a whole slush fund of public money show up at the polls to vote for the thing, because most people don't take the time to educate themselves on what usually is at least 10 propositions on there. And, of course, they all know that they're worded in a very tricky and deceptive way. They think that if I vote yes, then it really means no. Or, you know, they get really confused, and they finally just throw their hands up and don't vote because they don't want to vote for something and say yes when, in fact, it's detrimental. So, anyway, we managed to stop a constitutional amendment election, and these things almost always pass with at least 70% of the vote, okay? We killed Proposition 4 last November, and it was going to, it had to do with these transportation reinvestment zones, or if you want to call them tax increment finance zones, but this is specific to transportation projects, because as you know, they haven't raised the state, or in our case, state federal gas tax, but also on the federal level, they haven't raised the gas tax since the early 90s. We're starting our road funds to try and push this toll agenda. That's what it really comes down to. They know how to fix our problem with road funding. You raise the gas tax, and if they had done it before the gas prices got to $4 a gallon, it would have been a whole lot better, but now it's a political suicide to even consider the thought. Yet tolls cost anywhere from 25 to 1,000 times more per mile to fund our roads that way. It's punitive and oppressive taxation that few people can afford, but they don't care about all that part of it. But to go back to this whole transportation reinvestment zone stuff, they're trying to look at literally shaking the bushes, trying to find every way possible to increase money for these transportation projects without calling it a tax hike. And that's what they do. These, like I said, they designate these zones and they take an increment of your property tax and dedicate it to that transportation project. And what I keep trying to tell these local governments is, I'm like, are you nuts? What you would normally fund with property taxes is now going to be diverted to a state highway when you already have city and county roads that you can barely afford to build and maintain. Now you're going to have some of your local tax revenues diverted to something the state has the responsibility to be doing. And yet they still push for this stuff because they want slush funds for all their developer buddies that you know, bring all the money into their campaign coffers. And we managed to stop this thing and educated the public about they were now going to try and raid your property taxes to build a toll road, yet you would then have to turn around and pay an additional tax, a toll, to use a road that was built with your property taxes. So obviously that didn't sit well with people, and it was one of the few that has ever been defeated in, I mean, anything in the, at least the last 20 or 30 years. Very few of these ever get defeated. So we were very proud of that, but I'll tell you, when people become aware of what is going on in their government, they, you know, the way it was worded never even mentioned transportation reinvestment zones. You had to go to the enabling legislation that was passed as a separate bill to even know what this amendment was actually going to do. And so by educating people about what was in the law and what kind of authority and land grabbing and tax grabbing that this was going to involve, people finally rose up and said, oh, no way you're going to do that. So we just have to, you know, really work on educating the public, and it's pretty much a slam dunk when you people realize what this really means.
Well, can you,
and I wanted to also touch on something here, because I know that we're at least winding down in our time together, that when we talked about the foreign takeover of our sovereign public infrastructure, one of the things we've archived on our website at texasturf.org, that's something I like to do on the homepage just to keep the information fresh and relevant, is I often will take portions of relevant news articles and just put them on there so people understand and help them connect the dots of what's really going on when it comes to transportation, public-private partnerships, and the domain and such. And some of the archived articles we have on there relate to the fact that China is now saying that as one of the ways that the U.S. debt that you know we owe them can be swapped out is by taking over U.S. public infrastructure in precisely public-private partnerships. Yes.
Right.
And
we're
when you look
with telecommunications at, all over the country.
This yes,
the
they
debt.
Are. And see, our governor here, you all got to learn a little bit about our governor, Rick Perry, during the presidential run. And boy, are we glad that he got knocked out very early on, because he would be a disaster for our country. And one of the reasons why is, you might know of the Chinese firm, I'm probably going to butcher how you pronounce it, but it's Huawei. It's H-U-A-W-E-I. And it is a telecommunications company that Rick Perry went and sought and tried to beg them to come to Texas and put their headquarters, which they did, and I believe it was Plano, Texas, which is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And just think about it now, that when we are going to hand over to the Chinese, this is the same company that wants to basically learn from our technology and be able to take over our telecommunications. But the other aspect of this was they were involved in a deal where they literally wanted access to this technology so that they can, if you can imagine, if they can hear the chatter on phone conversations here in America, there's all kinds of national security implications to that, whether it's defense contracting companies or what have you. And we had a governor here who was willing to sell all of that off, you know, and this was a company that was already listed by both the Republican and Democrat administration, both Bush and Obama's administration, as a threat to national security. Our governor was off for begging this company to come to Texas and to put roots down here and get involved in the telecommunications industry here in the U.S. I mean, this is what's going on. And I'll tell you, Rosa, you're right. in Texas, people think because they've listened to and bought the rhetoric of these politicians, they think that we're this conservative, states' rights, state sovereignty kind of a state, low taxes and all of that. They have no clue what's actually been occurring in their own government, because what we see happen in Texas and a lot of other states, and frankly on the federal level it happens all the time too, it is called cronyism. And crony capitalism has destroyed the state of Texas, whether it comes to property rights, transportation, infrastructure, even schools, I mean, you name it, all of this stuff has been corrupted by crony capitalism. And that is what, when you talk about foreign trade zones, these enterprise zones, you name it, the corporatocracy always finds a way to buy themselves access to the public treasury to get state or federally sanctioned monopolies on infrastructure or whatever, and they find a way to get tax breaks that you and I, the ordinary citizen, would never be able to benefit from. And that's who really runs this country and the world, as far as I'm concerned, is the special interest, whether it's corporations or the global elite class and these NGOs, the non-governmental organizations and such, UN, you name it. That's who's really pulling the strings. It's those behind the puppets,
right?
We have to expose.
One of the things that
this is something that I have seen. Of course, the environmental movement has been totally hijacked. And when you see that all of your news outlets are owned by five huge mega corporations, you're not going to be hearing the truth on the mainstream media. And one thing that we've seen also is the takeover of our school system through outcome-based education, where we're actually being directed not to learn anything but to be good citizens, meaning that we are going to go along to get along. They are breeding people who are not going to look deeply into the rhetoric, who are not
right.
going to ask questions. And when you look at, I'll tell you something. We're talking about our own country. This is our nation, and we're talking about the enemy, and we're talking about our government. And this is a very upsetting thing to a lot of people, but you've got to just get over that and get on board, because this is the reality. When you have, for instance, something like Google, which, if you're talking about Huawei, which is, the telecommunications corporation that is wholly owned by the country of China.
Chinese government.
And is actually, we have Cintra, that is a Spanish corporation that is owned by the Prince of Spain, or
That's
when you
right.
have these, or how about, let's just bring it on home here. How about Google that is working with, your CIA and Interpol to examine every single thing that you check out on the internet, and the wife of the Google founder, Sergey Brin's wife, I can't think of her name right now. She owns 23andMe, which is the DNA tests. If you want to find out, let's see, who am I related to? Am I really a Native American? They spit in a cup and you send off your DNA.
Oh, my word.
23andMe, well, check it out. That is owned by Google. They own, and what do they do with that information? You just found out.
Data
yeah,
mining.
Yeah,
it's farming it out and selling off the information.
Data mining.
It's data mining, too, where they sell off, they sell off the information. It's a private company that obtains it, not the government.
It goes beyond the sale of your personal data. It goes beyond that. We're talking about something like Nazi Germany here. We are talking about the ownership of your DNA and the control of your ability to live or die. And I'm sorry, but you know what? This goes way beyond who's owning your infrastructure. It's who's owning your body. And how are you able to control how you live? And whether you breed or not, whether you have children, what kind of quality of life you're going to have. This plan that we're talking about, we have not deviated from talking about United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development for one second. This is all part of the same plan.
Yes.
And it is actually a way to identify us as potential enemy combatants. You saw that through the National Defense Authorization Act. Through its redefining torture, you see that with the Patriot Act. They are changing every land use document in the country to require a building design style that will allow us to be surveilled and controlled and managed. One of the problems that the Nazis had in World War II was that they had difficulty in spying on everything, on everyone, because they still had an old system for, telephones and mail. They couldn't open every single piece of mail. Now we have surveillance in place that can surveil they can go through the equivalent of the New York telephone book every minute. There's so much information that can be data mined now, and not just for what they can sell you, but how you can be controlled. And this is what's really powerful. This is what we're really looking at.
I agree, and we haven't even touched on today the smart meters and
yeah.
some of these other types of electromagnetic radiation devices that are being installed against people's will on their homes that can literally shut down all the appliances in your home if the government deems that you're using too much. Or in any other situation, if they want brownouts, power outs, if they want to, all of this, they benefit from the scarcity of public resources, whether it's scarcity of roads, scarcity of power or water. They want that to happen because then people beg the government to step in to redistribute that, because then there's so many that are without that they're willing to forego freedom in order to have government control of our basic necessities. And so that's one of the ways they're doing it. And smart meters will mess with your brain.
It's perfect that you actually put your finger on that, because this is, all totalitarian states all totalitarian states have the same thing in common. They have full and total control of information and movement and resources and production. And then they also have this philosophy of Spartanism, control. And the individual is selfish. You have to be thinking about the common good. Anything that's excessive, of course, for the rulers, this doesn't apply. But anything that's excessive needs to be, drawn in and conserved. And they also have the same vision of the glorious future. And that's what you see, with this technocracy, with the smart grid. Is how fabulous this is going to be, because, we're going to be conserving everything, and so we're going to have these beautiful, shiny, high-speed trains, and everyone's lives are going to be so lovely, and we're all going to be downstairs in the downstairs coffee shop drinking coffee, and no one's going to have to work.
Of course, it's a utopia, a government-controlled utopia.
Government utopia, and meanwhile, your existence in your current life is about Spartanism and terror. The war on terror is a war on you. This is all, these facets of a totalitarian state are all shared by every totalitarian government, including Nazi Germany and Communist China and Russia. And we are seeing that. People are not educated enough to recognize that this is being put in place right now in our country.
Well, they're willing to tell us anything to bring it about. But I did want to bring something back a little bit when you were talking about being able to take this land and by a municipality and take more land than they need and maybe sell off part of it to finance part of it. What did you mean by not legal in California?
Well, under projects, when you're acquiring land for a project, specifically, let's say for a transportation project, there's a process by which you identify the project itself, and then you identify the limits of the project. And it's not legal to acquire more land than is necessary, absolutely necessary for that project. So you can't acquire land for a transportation project and then put housing on it. But this is something that has changed now here with especially with local projects, because with Senate Bill 375 and Assembly Bill 32, and you'll see this across the country, this is where they put together the greenhouse gas legislation and the transportation legislation to say that you have to have high-density housing on transportation corridors. And that's where they get around it, because then they can acquire property through eminent domain.
Yes.
When they bring you into those visioning projects, those visioning meetings, you know, where they ask you what you want to see, funny, they all end up wanting to see exactly the same thing no matter where you are in the country. You want to see walkable, bikeable, vibrant downtown areas where everyone can, you know, just get around easily and live in their little apartment up above the store. You know, the reality is this is very difficult to finance if you're actually going to go to a bank for it. And so most people who own that land right now are never going to be able to actually develop it. So it requires subsidies. And in order for your government to be, you know, to justify subsidizing you to build that, you've got to have a track record constructing high-density development, you know, ground floor mixed use with residential above. Most people don't. So they're going to go to high, to big developers to do that. And then so your local people are not going to get that money, and they're also not going to get, the tax dollars, sales tax dollars, because oftentimes, as you said, Melody, it's going to be in a zone where they're actually forgiven, their debt forgiveness zones or their tax forgiveness zones, or they have no recourse loans. So this is how this works, but you're not supposed to identify property required for a project unless it is absolutely necessary for that particular project. And these are highway projects.
Okay, now what about if it's with water? Have you run across this?
You're talking about if it's going to be like for
A municipal
aqueduct or something? Or,
like a municipal water use.
Water lines, infrastructure lines. You know, this is part of complete streets. It's not necessarily water, but if you're talking about a transportation project on a local street and you want to be able to provide, bike lanes in that street so that people on bicycles can get around. But in fact, for complete streets, you have to have mixed use on both sides of the street. So then they can justify along, you know, with that transportation project of putting in the bike lanes. Well, they just end up taking the property on both sides of the street, demolishing it, and building these high-density developments to justify their smart growth.
Okay, now what if you had a...
It also increases the cost of the infrastructure project in and of itself, because now you can't just build a road or expand a highway or add a shoulder or add a lane. Now you have to make way for bike lanes, or you have to do a bike path, and even not even on that project itself. Like, for instance, one of the arguments I made against the complete streets bill in the state legislature was, what do we need sidewalks on a state highway for? People, when they drive on, you know, when you're driving on a state highway going 65, 70 miles an hour, that's not where moms are strolling with their strollers, or people in wheelchairs or what have you. That's not where they need a sidewalk. That's all on your city and county roads. Why would we even need this on the state level? And, of course, they had to spin it, you know, and find a way to answer that question. And so one of the things they said, well, so it doesn't have to be on that actual project. It's just part of the cost of the project. So basically it's a way for them to raid transportation money to go stick a hike and bike trail or a complete street someplace else using state highway money. And, again, making your road capacity, more scarce, because now your project is getting so ungodly expensive that you're going to have to toll it to ever come up with the money to pay for these things. The other procurement procedure that I think is interesting to bring up is, you know, in these public-private partnerships, a portion of that, if you have a fully built-out public-private partnership, or should I say the complete model, is a concession model, where the private developer gets the rights to own, operate, and maintain it, and collect the lease or what have you over a long leasehold. Well, there's another type of procurement that is similar to a public-private partnership. It's actually the first two steps of a public-private partnership, and it doesn't allow the full-blown concession model, which is another flavor of the month that these guys have discovered,
coming.
And it's called design-build. And design-build contracts are also very similar to what you described on those mixed-use developments, because, and they use them in all kinds of situations. It's not just for roads. Some of it is for these mixed-use type developments where the cities are coming in and giving all kinds of taxpayer subsidies or tax breaks to to these developers who want to put in these high-rise, you know, residential mixed-use places. But what we see happen is only the big guns have the ability to do a design-build procurement. Your mm-hmm. small businesses and your small general contractors do not have the resources to finance such a project on the front end the way that these big guys do. So what we're doing is we're handing over almost virtually all development
right.
to a handful of well-connected developers in your state, and some of them are even national companies. They're not even, like in our case, these aren't Texas companies. They're huge conglomerates that are in every state.
They can be sold to a foreign entity. Could they not?
Yes, and they know, and they know how to work these local city councils and these legislators and everybody else. They know how to do the bids. They can, they've got a template already pulled out that they can just plunk these things down very easily. When you're a small guy, you don't have somebody that's dedicated to just writing these government proposals in your office. So a lot of this is about taking away free market, period. And they're turning everything into this special interest monopolies, and really their cartels. It's just like oil in our world is controlled by a handful of cartels, and the rest of us are feeling the brunt of that because it's not really truly free market principles that guide
not
the price
all.
Of oil.
Yeah.
They consider us to be the special interests, which is really a it's a riot. If you go, you know, we've had this experience where we're fighting these projects, and you know, we go in as as groups of individuals to speak out in front of our councils or in front of these regional boards that are unelected, that are made up of elected officials that do not respond to us. And we'll go up there and we'll speak the truth, and we'll be told, you know, we'll hear them say that we're special interests. And in fact, I think people are becoming aware of how their rhetoric is being manipulated. Just recently, the American Planning Association came out with a 12-week boot camp, which communications boot camp for planners and elected officials, where they basically instructed planners and elected officials to change the rhetoric because we were becoming aware of what was going on around the country, and we were going out and speaking out and disrupting these meetings that they're holding and saying that that people are being manipulated and calling out the truth. And so instead of meeting us on an open and clean battlefield, as it were, they're still sneaking and hiding. And I think, you know, Terry, one thing that you were talking about, which is, you know, how the developers have their templates and they can go in and across the country they have representatives and they can just drop these plans in front of, you know, your little local community and they just go, okay, we'll go for it. Well, not only do the developers have these templates, but that project that I told you about that the President's Council on Sustainable Development funded the American Planning Association to come up with Growing Smart legislative guidebook with model statutes for planning and the management of change. So model statutes are, in fact, what are used by your planning department. That staff, you know, that presents those ordinances to your city council and county supervisors to sign off on, they didn't come up with those statutes.
That's right.
Those laws. That stuff is
it's
given
part of
to them.
The national playbook. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And there's the National Association of Legislators or something like that, too, where exactly where that complete streets legislation came into Texas.
Right.
It wasn't something that bubbled up from our local state legislators.
Right.
This was, they sent a couple of state legislators to this national brouhaha somewhere, and they come back with all of this, quote, model legislation that every state just has to have. And they put it, you know, and couch it in all these talking points and platitudes about making our streets safer for the disabled and people who need to use bikes and strollers. And I said, there is no purpose for that on a state highway where people are going 70 miles an hour.
Okay, now
and that's how nuts it is.
I contend that you have these people going around the country selling these infrastructure projects, and they go from city to city, county to county, state to state, whatever, and that they put these entities into debt so that down the road they can turn around and do these swaps or do the municipalities, government
or raise
entities,
taxes,
and then they will sell off the commons.
The plan.
What?
This is the plan, is to bankrupt
our nation
and completely make us so that we are totally in debt at this and in this point where, look at, I mean, did you know that one of the largest, the largest segment of the population that has school debt, and I'm talking about university debt, is beginning to be the over 50 group. People who went back to school to try and make themselves more viable and, you know, out there in the work world and instead are saddled with tremendous debt. This is the way to sink an economy and a way to collapse the people, because when you are desperate for money and you will, when you're desperate for money, when you're desperate for a job, you will literally do anything. And this is what they want. They want people who are willing to sell out, sell each other out. You know, you want to know who's doing this to you? This isn't just those elected officials. These are people who are in your neighborhood association, in your local boards and commissions, unelected, people who are speaking for you, saying that they represent you. They're developing these so-called neighborhood associations and neighborhood alliances where people are being farmed, who are willing to go along to get along, people who are willing to sell you out, people who are willing to lie to you in order to get some little award or to get put on a commission. This is what's happening in our country. It's a complete subversion of our social structure, the quality of our life. Because, you know, when you think about smart growth, those developments that are down there in the center of your town, those people don't live long in apartments. They move in and out. This is a destroyer of community. It's a loss of diversity. It's total displacement, and it's a corporatocracy. It's the opposite of what they tell you when you go to those visioning meetings.
Well, and you know, another thing, Rosa, that you bring up we haven't brought it up overtly, but when you look at the results of what they're doing, it is an attack also on families. Because families don't want to live in apartments. They want to have a yard for their kids to play in. And, like, for me, I have 8 children. I cannot live in one of these downtown mixed-use little cramped apartments with 8 kids, and I can't even so much as grocery shop on a bicycle. You know, I mean, this is not how families live. Why do you think there was the rise of Suburbans and of SUVs? It's because the moms loved it because they could fit the kids and the cargo and a couple of extra friends and go on a little day trip or a picnic or, you know, go to a soccer game or whatever it might be. But the way that these master planners view the world is not family friendly. And it's an attack on family size as well. And, of course, me, you know, they want someone like me to just die because they don't want me to have any more children because I'm unsustainable, according to them, and I'm contributing to the unsustainability of normal living, you know. So, anyway, you get the idea that there is an aspect to this very, very, very anti-family because it's really about 1 or 2 people occupying an apartment somewhere in a very transient lifestyle that there's no sense of real community. It may look really quaint on an architectural drawing that they show you in a visioning workshop, but that's not really going to connect you with your neighbors.
Exactly, and it's not intended to. What it's actually intended to do is to keep you separate from your neighbors, to keep it so that you don't care when your neighbors are taken away in the middle of the night. It doesn't matter to you what happens because people come in and out, and you have no true community. And, you know, Carrie, it's exactly as you say. These are, you know, the people who are making these rules are young planners, just out of college, burdened with tremendous debt. They don't have children. They can't afford to have families. They can only afford to live in apartments. This is, you know, the creation of people who are designed to, they're being trained and being schooled in how to create regulations and restrictions on land use and property use.
And so when you have people who are being trained right up from K through 12 and right into the advanced grades in actually designing more and more restrictions on how you can live, these are not people that you can actually convince of your point of view. And so this is part of what happens when you go to those visioning meetings. If you're anti-Delphi-ing those meetings, and by the way, in my book, I have 20 pages in the back of my book about how to fight this and what to do. And one of the things I talk about is how to anti-Delphi a meeting, how to take over these meetings where you go and they're actually trying to indoctrinate you and direct you to give them the right answer for what they want to do to your town. And what you want to do there is make sure that you understand that you're not going to change the facilitator's point of view. You're out there speaking to your neighbors, to the people who are out there attending those meetings and who need to hear the truth, because you're not going to hear the truth in these public meetings. You're going to be lied to by your government, who's paying consultants to lie to you. And then, you know, when you get this information out there, when you flyer people, flyering is very powerful to release this information to people, to provide it. You make newsletters, you have a website, you get out there with this information, you hand it out to people. When they walk into a meeting and they have a flyer in their hand that says, notice, you are being Delphi'd, they recognize then when they're in the meeting and they get Delphi'd. It's up to you who are, you know, those of you who are listening, to be part of this resistance that we are part of out here and to fight with us, because, like I said, it's not a left-right thing. This is for all of us to get on board together and stop this, because we are losing our country.
Does home rule fit into any of this Agenda 21, or is that a total different thing?
Home rule?
Mm-hmm.
It's part of it. When you have charter cities, when you have strong mayors, you're talking about little local dictatorships. I do not support charter cities. I think that what you have is an extreme overreach of what a city is able to do, and you have to look at who you're giving that power to, and it's very dangerous.
And so, when you're saying charter, you're meaning home rule, then, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, because we keep having this brought up in my area periodically. And I think they're mm-hmm. trying to do it again.
Yeah, they bring it up in my little town, too, north of San Antonio. It's not it is an incorporated city, but it's not a home rule city. And twice, a bunch of developers, and, of course, this doesn't surprise you ladies or your audience, but it did to some of my neighbors, to find out that the same group of developers were the only campaign contributors to every single city council member and the mayor. And twice, and during this mayor's term in office, they tried to push home rule on the people. And we saw through all of the schemes of these guys, and twice they voted it down. And you should see the abusive articles that this mayor would write in a community paper, you know, abusing citizens who spoke out and told the truth, trying to say that we were mm-hmm. backwards and, you know, we were against progress. I mean, you name everything. It's just, just a bunch of hicks out here. You'll never grow up and be a real city unless you do what I tell you to. And it's just unbelievable, the abuses of power that these people get. And sometimes it's these little small-town mayors in a home rule city. You wouldn't believe the kind of power they can wield if they're a home rule city. And so we wanted to diffuse that power base, just like you're talking about. Anytime you can diffuse that power instead of centralizing it, it's a win for the public.
Well, you know, one of the things that I question, and maybe I'm way, way off base on this, but I just wonder about, you know, every government entity is incorporated. I'm wondering about if we should, you know, drop the charters on these things so that they can't be incorporated, because it seems like that's all they're worrying about is the dollar instead of the public.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because one of the early on battles that we took to our tolling authority, who was trying to toll our existing freeway out here, was the fact that the city of San Antonio and Bexar County, that's our, you know, obviously local city and county entities, and they gave loans of taxpayer money to a political subdivision of the state. That's the technical legal term for what our tolling authority was. And they gave loans of money to them. Well, the San Antonio City Charter does not allow them to lend money to anybody. The taxpayers are not a bank. And therefore, they shouldn't be loaning our money to this toll entity. And it was for their startup costs, basically, until they had a toll road on the ground and started getting a revenue stream. Well, that was one of the legal challenges that we were starting to make. And we have still made hay over this for, probably, what's it been now, 7 years. And I'm telling you, we've had some real success, at least in the court of public opinion. We've never actually brought suit against them, but we have gone to the city council, and multiple times they've had huge debates over whether or not they're going to continue to forgive this loan. What happened was it came due in September of 2009, and because of our litigation that stopped the toll road twice, they had no toll road on the ground yet, so they had no revenue stream, and they owed the money all this, or owed the city all this money with interest, and they had no way to pay it back. And so we said they defaulted on the loan, closing down. We were hoping it was a way we could completely shut down this, you know, second-tier bureaucracy who does nothing but sit around and come up with ways to tax you and take away your freedom to travel and tinker around with who is allowed to use our freeways and who's not based on how many people are in your car or what your income is. And so anyway, the city council ended up twice now voting to extend the loan another year, hoping that the RMA can pull together something, or that's the tolling authority, pull together something on this. But I think that there can be a legal challenge made if these cities continue to act outside of what their charter allows them to do. Surely there's a way we can pull the plug on their charter and say you no longer can be a valid city because of XYZ things. And of course they do this all the time on bond elections, where they tell you that the bond money is for XYZ project, and then they turn around and decide and change their mind, you know, a year or two down the road and use the money on something else, deceiving the voters. Mm-hmm. All of these things need to be challenged. We have to, if we come at them every single time that they do this to us, over time there has to be some little loophole somewhere or something that we can exploit in the charter to show that, you know, you're no longer acting as a valid, you know, city, and, you know, shut them down, defuse their power.
I literally had a poller call me over the weekend, and in the process of this polling thing, I mean, I actually do go through the process because it tells me what's going on in an area. And when they were, it was though they were trying to figure out what they could sell the public to try to come up with $550,000. So,
oh, wow.
I'm going, you mean to tell me you don't even have a project? You're just trying to figure out how to sell it? I mean,
Unbelievable. I've seen that. You know, they do that with high speed rail or with rail projects, because oftentimes they're, you know, they'll use sales tax dollars. Well, they'll add a quarter cent to your sales taxes or something like that, and say that they're going to you know, produce a train, you know, a transportation mode, which is a high speed train, and then it turns out that in fact that train, there's never going to be enough money for the train. Of course, the fare box is never going to cover it, never would.
Right.
And so they design these things, they know that there's not going to be enough tax revenue for it. They underestimate the cost of the project, and then they basically use it as a cash cow for different, you know, different private projects, or they ship the money to individual developers, or they buy land along the route and pay certain property owners for it. And you find that these end up being crony projects that the citizens are simply being manipulated at the, you know, at the ballot box. If they actually get an opportunity to vote, they're either being lied to when the ballot, you know, on the ballot, literally being lied to, or they're not given the information, or the information is twisted and the project may never happen, but once your dollars are committed to it, then that can go on in perpetuity. So I agree with you, Terry. I mean, these are things that, you know, it's simply a total luxury to think that you can just sit back and do nothing. The people need to step
that's
up.
That's for
now.
Sure.
Well, we all
and they do,
know.
And you've got to fight them. And the one thing that is easy to do now, see, I've been able to pretty much focus on transportation related issues and property rights and eminent domain as part of that. But what we see happening a lot of times, let's say with a Tea Party movement or another type of a group like that, that's rising up to fight Agenda 21, they will exhaust themselves trying to stop every little thing because they're so happy that they've discovered, you know, oh, this is Agenda 21, let's stop that. And, oh, this is Agenda 21, too, let's stop that. You do have to be somewhat strategic in what you're fighting because they will exhaust you. They will wear you out. You will always have more meetings and hearings and things to do to stop these guys than you will ever have time to actually effectively accomplish.
Well,
so you have to be strategic about how you tackle this stuff. And obviously you want to go for the low-hanging fruit. And sometimes you just have to dig in for a long, hard battle on a really big project, like the Trans-Texas Corridor. And, you know, it's interesting you talked about these groupthink visioning seminars and these consultants that always manipulate the public hearing process to always have the public pick the outcome that they predetermined before we ever walked in the door. Well, we were very effective early on in garnering public opposition to the Trans-Texas Corridor because I'm sure you're familiar, Rosa, with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. NEPA are the hearings that guide, or well, it's really a federal law, but that is the NEPA hearings are very, very specific, and they have to follow federal rules in how they disseminate the information and get public comment and how they receive and respond to that public comment. And so at all the NEPA hearings, we would have our table out front. We'd have our petitions there for people to sign. We had our flyers out there that educated people about what they're not going to tell you inside but what this project's going to do. We told them how to get access to the actual documents so they knew that we weren't lying to them. They can go look it up for themselves on page number, whatever, and tell them exactly where what we said could be found. And so we were really effective. I mean, we gathered tens of thousands of signatures. In fact, it was close to 100,000 signatures total in just the first two Trans-Texas Corridor routes and the hearing process. And what they did shortly after that, when we, especially the second route, we got even better on the second round of hearings at collecting information and telling people how to get their comments and how to word them in such a way so that it would be counted on the record. Because TxDOT would be really sneaky and they would say, oh, well, we're not going to count the comments that just say we don't want the Trans-Texas Corridor. They had to speak specifically to the environmental document and cite things from the document or the purpose and need of the project and or address, you know, failures of the document in order for them to be able to have their comment count. So we had a lot of people put comments on the record on the first route, but they didn't count a bunch of them. But by the second route, we were very, very specific in how people had to submit their comments to ensure that they would make it on the record. And when there were 28,000 people that had put written comments in on the record, it was the most of any public hearing process in Texas state history. And it got the attention of our legislature. I mean, they were quaking in their boots. They had never seen anything like it, and they knew they were in trouble in their next election if they didn't do something to stop this corridor, or at least make people believe that it was good. And so then, shortly after that success, and we also got the moratorium on the public-private partnerships in that very next legislative session. Well, guess what happened? They started using this groupthink, what would you call it, like managed seminars and consultants managed seminars where they changed how they did the public hearing process so that there was no longer an open mic where we could stand up there and educate people about the project and take the words that these guys tell you and tell them what it really means and how it affects your property, your land use, and your ability to, you know, get your kids to school and blah, blah, blah. Well, now they have it so that unless it's an official NEPA public hearing, all of the public meetings done by our highway department and cities and counties even too, they all follow the same playbook because they all hire the same consultants. Now they have you spread out. It's a divide and conquer and keep you away from an open mic. They want to put you in little work groups, and you have a facilitator that's got a flip chart, and you've got, and you probably have all this in your book, but just to give people the idea here, they make sure that all the comments, they might write it up there on that flip chart, but the only comments that pass through to the actual final document that they recommend the preferred alternative or the preferred project, they do that, and somehow all the opposition just fell off the page and never made it to the final report.
I've always figured that those
really
are used
way
as
to submit comments, and you know, written comments are very manipulated. And of course, they try and have facilitators and plants—I call them plants, moles, whatever you want to call them. in each group so that they always have someone constantly promoting positive thinking about what alternative they want us to choose. And they always try to silence the people who have any opposition to what their goal is. And there's no way to get the entire audience. Yes. And so there's no way to get your point of view across to anybody unless you have somebody sitting at literally every table in the room.
Yeah, but I think that
only if you're successful in shutting down the consultant.
Yeah, but I think they take all those comments and use them and cull out those. Go ahead, Rosa. I said, I think they take all those comments and use them to come back and rebut any of them. They just pull them out, and that's what I think.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
right. They do use the comments, and they actually become fast on their feet. They do change their process. Anytime you're effective, they will come back the next time around with a new process. But we have been very effective here in California with anti-Delphi-ing meetings, where we go out and we take over those meetings, the meetings that they won't allow public comment. We have effectively shut that down. I've got some videos on YouTube of us doing that. If you look up my name, Rosa Corey, near riot at Delphi meeting, you'll see one where we did that. Now, this is one thing that I really want to encourage people. You're not going to, you know, this is the days for being polite and nice are over. You know, you can't just go and sit in one of those meetings and not say anything, because that means that you're going along to get along. You're compliant. Don't be compliant. You know, I'm very impressed with what Terry did with the Trans-Texas Corridor. Now, that is a really impressive win. But it's also partly because it was having such a tremendous impact on such a huge number of people.
Yes, it was a huge 10,000-pound gorilla that no one could ignore.
Right, but when you're looking at local regional projects that, you know, people, their eyeballs glaze over when they hear this stuff because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to think about it. It's up to you, those of you who are listening, to recognize that this is just the step in globalization, and that is a threat to the way that you're living your life right now. So if you go to one of those meetings like the one that Terry's talking about, where they just don't allow you to speak. You know what? Now you'll see in these meetings they're actually bringing police in.
They intimidate you. I've actually been threatened multiple times to be thrown out of meetings when I get to a mic and start telling people the truth. They've often tried to do that. In fact, one of our documentary films, we've had a professional filmmaker that lives here in San Antonio who's done things for the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and even feature films, and he's taken our cause under his wing, and he's produced a series of films called Truth Be Told, Truth, and then the word B, and then T-O-L-L-E-D, and you can go to truthbetold.com and do some of it. Most of the movies are up online in chunks on YouTube or other.
And they're well done. They're well done.
At the end of the day, the latest movie that we put together was on this 281 corridor, the road that got me involved in this whole mess in the first place. And the very first set of meetings that he captured on film had to do with a person was up at the mic, and this was during a regular NEPA hearing where we actually could do an open mic and talk to the audience about what was going on. And they directed him to turn and face the TxDOT employee.
Yeah.
They would not let him turn around and speak to his fellow citizens. And he refused to do it. He kept kept facing the audience. He said, I don't need to look at you when I'm saying this. It doesn't matter who I'm looking at. You're just supposed to record what I say. And they just persisted in telling him that it's like the Gestapo, you know, you either do what we say or we're going to throw you out. And they literally had him surrounded by police, and he finally backed off and faced the guy and finished his comments. But they were going to arrest this guy and throw him out of this meeting for simply looking the wrong direction, quote. And they threatened to do that to me at a town hall meeting, too. So, I mean, this is their modus operandi, intimidate if they can't silence you another way.
And you know what? The thing about that that is fabulous, I love it when they do that, because people need to see
more filming. That's right.
You know, they need to see that your police
they don't believe it.
And that your government is actually out there. What, you know, like what I say is, hey, we're most of us middle class, middle age. What, are you afraid we're going to say something? Is that why you bring the cops in the room? And this is what they have. They have police officers in every one of these meetings now. We had a canine officer with a dog. And so what you need to know
is that you have to get as many people to those meetings as possible so that they can witness their government turning on them with police dogs if they stand up and say, I see that this plan is not the right plan for me. If you're saying a thing like that, you're a threat to the people who are running your city. And it's nothing better than witnessing that, you know, in person.
You're absolutely right. It's so funny. And, you know, since that time, I've been able to, and I don't know why, I think it's just, I don't know, the Lord just blessed us with favor with the talk radio community. But I'll tell you this, we have, you know, just about any time I need to get on talk radio, I can do that here in Texas. And they come to us as a source for, you know, they want, you know, newspapers make their living on media outlets, make their living on conflict, and they know that TxDOT's going to give them one side, and they know they can come to us for another because we know our stuff. And, you know, we're a huge activist group now around the state that they're aware of. And so, anyway, I say this because one of the things we've been able to do is make this such a huge issue and educate so many thousands of people around our state. And we're on radio a lot, especially here in San Antonio. People kind of consider me an extension of themselves as just, you know, the homeschool mom, you know, the ordinary middle-class citizen who's fighting for the taxpayer. They know where my loyalties are. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I have no dog in the fight other than to protect our freedoms. And so they really do trust what we have to say, and that's part of what you can do is the earned media, where you can do as much as you can to put out press releases and work with your local press to show the other side of the story. If nothing else, I demand equal time. I'll say, look, you just had so-and-so developer on. Now you need to have me on for equal time. You know, because you're just giving one side here. And so I use that. But one of the things that's so funny that we've been able to do, because a lot of people know my name now, and I'll go up. The first thing I do when I arrive at one of these public meetings now is I go right up to the police officers. And I say, hi, thanks for being here tonight. You know, I try not to be adversarial. I know why they brought them in. But you know what I'm saying? So I just kind of snooze, and then eventually they'll go, oh, yeah, you're that toll road lady. You know, they'll say, oh, right. You're that whatever, you know. And they go, oh, nice to meet you, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm telling you, when I tell them, oh, yeah, man, I'm fighting for our freedom and to keep our roads free. Can you believe they're going to come and try and slap a toll on 281? You know, and I'll talk with them about X, Y, Z, or I'll say, can you believe that Trans-Texas Corridor? What a land grab. And so I'll start talking and schmoozing with them, and I'm telling you, within 10 minutes, they're eating out of my hands.
Good
they're
move,
like,
Terry.
They're on our side because they're like, yeah, they she's just like us. You know, she's fighting for us. And if you can do that, you can really diffuse that element. And I found that they have never intimidated our people when we do that. They don't come up to this. If the facilitator tries to get those cops and tries to stick those cops on us, they don't do it nearly in the way that they used to do it when we didn't reach out to the cops first. And I'll tell you, that is so true. I've had the same thing happen at the state capitol in Texas. I'm up there all the time during the legislative session advocating for the people. And finally, the Capitol Police, the guys that, you know, they now have security everywhere. We didn't used to have that problem. In Texas, it's been very recent. They had a guy come in and threaten lawmakers with a gun. And so now they have literally security everywhere. Well, inevitably, when there's been a session, I am nursing a baby. So I always bring a baby with me. I've got the stroller, and it is, you can't imagine, you people have seen this at airport security screening, what a nightmare it is to have a stroller and laptops and everything else that you have to go through security multiple times every time you go in the House gallery, every time you go in the Senate gallery, every time you go in anywhere into a legislative hearing or into the building, you have to go through all the security screening. Well, finally, these guys noticed that I'm always there, and I stand out like a sore thumb because I've got this baby with me all the time, and I usually have one of my older girls as a mama's helper that helps me, and we just stick out like a sore thumb. And they finally come up to me, and they just go, well, ma'am, can I just ask, why are you here? You know, they're like, they can't figure out. I don't look like a lobbyist. They know that surely I have lots to do besides sit here and babysit government because I've got these sweet little babies with me and everything. And I tell them, I said, I'm fighting for you. And they're like, well, wow, what do you mean? And then I start telling them about what we're doing. And I tell you what, those guys were like eaten out of my hand, too. They were just wonderful people, and they knew which side I was on. And, you know, the pages and stuff would try and come up and, you know, give me problems about, you know, the baby or a stroller or where I parked something or whatever. And those guys would come up to them and say, lay off. And they would actually be very protective of me. There was another time where our filmmaker was filming something in the House gallery as part of our film. And he goes, ma'am, I just want to let you know that this guy keeps filming you. Did you want me to do something about that? And I just said, oh, you're so sweet. I said, no, actually, he's with me, and it's okay. And he goes, okay, good, okay, you know. So anyway, it's great when you can reach out to them and try to diffuse that whole thing where they're trying to use the police against we the people. Remind them where you stand, whose perspective you're defending, and they will be on your side, and they'll be right there with you, and they will be very reticent to be abusive of their power.
Okay, guys.
Obviously, if there's someone that's
actually, we're finding that there's a group that's actually getting my book to all the sheriffs in California.
Good.
A plan to get my book to all the sheriffs across the country. And I've found also that police officers come up and shake my hand at the, you know, after we've done these meetings and say, now I understand this issue. Now,
exactly.
And these are guys
exactly.
who have often been deployed to go and police the Occupy, meetings. And they say, well, you know, this is kind of interesting to come here and listen to you and listen to, you know, your people and see what you guys are talking about. And I find that they are very, very interested. They want to understand what's going on, and they're very polite and appreciative after, you know, we've gone and talked with them and they've listened through the entire meeting because they're in there hearing everything we're talking about.
Exactly. So they're doing their job, and they can't help but listen to what's going on. And at mm-hmm. the end of the day, they realize, and that's what, like you said, Rosa, because it's not a left-right issue. And that's one thing that we've allowed the elites to really kind of try to divide up our country along the supposedly ideological party lines. But really this is about we the people against the elite. And whether it's our government elite or, the corporatocracy elite, whatever you want to call the special interests that really are the puppeteers or the puppet masters behind the puppets, that's who's really running the show. And that's really the enemy here. It's not, our police officers or those in authority necessarily. Now, some probably,
right.
you know, there's always bad apples. But at the end of the day, we have far more in common with each other than they have even with their own bosses and
okay.
the people who call the shots.
Are you guys
so, you know, they don't get paid a lot of money. Same thing with our military guys. Our military, you know, San Antonio, it's Military Town USA. Our military people are totally against what they're doing, they're taking away our freedom to travel. They don't want these toll roads. They are on very limited salaries. They don't get paid a whole lot of money. They're just, you know, salt of the earth kind of people too. And they are big supporters of what we're doing. And so the more you can reach out to people, whether it's military or the police or other groups, I mean, one thing they can't accuse me of here is even though they know I'm a Republican, I have a lot of Democrat support. Because they know that I will, if they ask me to come speak to their group, I will talk to anybody who lets me in the door. I don't care what group
me
it is.
Me too.
Because
exactly
we find that, exactly, and we find that we have far more in common with one another than what we always have with these hat party lines that were fed by the mass media and those in power. They want us to think that we've got this huge divide in our country and an ideological divide between, you know, how everybody views the world. But when they start to see that it doesn't matter which party's in power, like you said, they vet these candidates. They make sure that no matter who's the president, he's one of them. He's an elitist and a globalist. They want to blur the lines of our national sovereignty, and they want to sell us out for the special interests. And as long as they know that they and their families are going to be taken care of by the elite, so therefore they're willing to sell out their fellow man. They sell out their own mothers, people.
Right.
If it means that they get a nice big fat check from somebody
yeah.
or a really nice lifestyle handed to them because they're part of the in crowd now. So, I would encourage people to not, if you're in a part of a Tea Party group or a 9/11 group or whatever you want to, whatever you've been working within, then it's really good to not be so set in your party ideology that you cut yourself off from natural allies.
Mm-hmm. Well, you guys,
exactly.
we're getting to the point where you need to bring this to a close, but I want to throw one question in here before we let you two wind it down, give closing comments. But what we have is with Agenda 21 is like a system to take We've already had the takeover, is what I've heard people saying, when we have nothing but corporations running everything as it is, and that the dollar is what rings supreme in this process, and that Agenda 21 is the way they're implementing the consolidation. Does that ring true to either one of you? No?
Absolutely.
Well, this is the plan. That's exactly right. The design is to take control of all of our natural resources, our land, our water, our means of production, our information systems, our bodies, and our educational system, our healthcare system, every part of the anywhere that we impact our environment, which is everything. And this is a totalitarian plan. So obviously, the more controllable you are, the more the more easy it is to do this plan. And so, of course, collapsing our economy is part of it, because then we'll be more desperate. We'll be asking for more government control and more government services, because we will need them more. So all of us need to be much more aware of that. So that when this, when we see the plan, it doesn't come with flashing lights and labels. It's many, many different names. And so you have to really, get yourself to the point where you recognize that it's almost not what is United Nations Agenda 21. It's what isn't. And you're going to have to look
long and hard
to find anything that isn't, because they've got it locked down here. So, read your local newspaper. And identify these plans, identify neighborhood revitalization projects, your neighborhood association, anything that's coming up for a vote in your council. Familiarize yourself. Start getting active and start recognizing who the players are. ICLEI, the International Council on Local Environmental Initiatives, is active and powerful across the United States and the world, and this is what's driving your greenhouse gas emissions controls and your climate adaptation.
Council of Governments? Governments?
Council of Government, the MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations. These are all, this is what's directing your regional plans. And so it's up to all of us no hero is going to save you here. You've got to get on board and do it yourself. And there are groups that are active. Terry has a phenomenal group, I think. It's very, wonderful. There are groups all across the country, and small groups, people who are just standing up together, working together, educating each other, and like Terry said, putting aside those very minor issues of who's a Republican, who's a Democrat, who's gay, who's straight, what religion you are. These are all, just things designed to keep us focused on each other and not focused on the people who are enacting these plans and producing the final product that they're looking for, which is total totalitarian government.
And it's like a corporate takeover ultimately, and that they're selling off the assets now. So
that's exactly
absolutely
right.
And something about those. When you look at the public-private partnerships and how that ties into Agenda 21 to kind of bring it all back together for people,
mm-hmm.
in case they're wondering still how that happens. Obviously, there's a property rights aspect, and there's the taxpayer subsidies and the loss of sovereignty. But really, if you look at the stated goals of Agenda 21, now I haven't read the whole document, but I've read a lot of it, and two of the stated goals are to restrict mobility and to abolish private property. And public-private partnerships do both. They restrict your mobility through tolling, and the tolls are so punitive and so oppressive and so much more in our transportation costs than our previously, gas tax-funded affordable public road system that was freely accessible to everybody. If you could put gas in your tank, you could use our roads. Now we're talking about anywhere from 25 to 1,000 times more money per mile. When they privatize the road, we're talking 75 cents a mile. That's like adding $15 to every gallon of gas you buy. If that can start putting into perspective how this will restrict your freedom to travel, and you will have no say over that toll rate for a half a century or more, and the debt load that is involved with these huge public infrastructure projects will literally last multiple generations. And this is not the way to go in how to fund our transportation and infrastructure in our country. And I really applaud Governor Nathan Deal out of Georgia. You probably know and heard about this huge hot lane project that blew up in their face there in Georgia. He was promoting the public-private partnerships. He was all about, you know, selling off these roads. The previous administration before he took office was all involved in this, and he pretty much just stepped in and continued it until the first hot lanes opened. And hot lanes are high occupancy toll lanes. And we already know that HOV lanes are basically where you have more than one person in your car. Carpoolers get to have access to those lanes, and it restricts the mobility of others. Well, now they have a way where, oh, they're more than willing to allow a single occupancy vehicle into that lane if they pay up,
if they pay a toll
for that. Well, the toll rate was so outrageous. It was something like $5 to go 4 or 5 miles or something like that, but it was a lot of money. The governor got so much blowback when those lanes, they turned an HOV lane into a hot lane, and they also increased the number of people you had to have in your car in order to qualify as a carpooler. So it was a very well-used HOV lane before they converted it to a toll lane. Once they converted it to a toll lane, you now had to have 3 people in your car. Well, that put a bunch of people that were normally in that lane into the regular general purpose lanes, causing even more congestion than when they had this lane as an HOV lane. And the cost of the toll was so outrageous, it made it so that that lane now was empty when before it was full and well-used. And so he had to step in and lower the toll rates within the first week of it opening. And since then, it's been a downward spiral for his public-private partnership program there, and they were about ready to go to contract or at least put out for bid another one of these public-private partnerships. They were going to sell off another portion of their roads there. And in his State of the State address this last year in January of 2012, the Governor Nathan Deal completely did a reversal on public-private partnerships and said, you know what, folks? I used to be for this, but there is a better path forward than to sell off our state sovereignty to private corporations.
All right.
And I was like, yes, amen, victory, you know. And then another huge power shift I've seen in our direction in just recent months. There was a great article put out by a member of the Cato Institute, something we didn't really mention yet today, but I'll say it just briefly here in closing. Is that the Reason Foundation, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, all of these so-called Competitive Enterprise Institute, you name it, all these think tanks have tried to promote these public-private partnerships as the quote-unquote free market solution to funding transportation. And they're trying to say, take it away from tax-funded roads to user fees. Well, gas taxes are a user fee. The more you use, the more you pay. Now, the only thing that pokes a hole in that argument is the fact that we do have some alt-fuel vehicles, but that's a very, very small percentage of people. And, of course, they say that fuel efficiency has eaten into that argument of that the more you use, the more you pay. But for the most part, our fuel efficiency has barely made a dent in gas tax revenues over the years. So at the end of the day, they try and call it a user fee, but we've already talked about how there's massive amounts of public money that go into these deals. So it's really not the user paying for the road. All of us are paying for the road, but only those who are wealthy enough to afford these punitive toll rates are the ones that can actually benefit from using the road.
Right.
So a Cato Institute scholar, so all these institutes have been very, very strong and organized in pushing this on government, saying that this is, oh, it's great, you don't have to raise taxes, and you can get all your roads built. And they act like the private entities just come in and build the roads for free, you know, like a little, you know, magic marker eraser or something, and just erases the tax burden. Well, no, it doesn't. It just puts taxation in the hands of private corporations, which is fascism. Well, this Cato Institute scholar just came out in recent weeks with an article rethinking their support of public-private partnerships.
Interesting.
And saying that it's a myth to call them free market. And so we're starting to see now that even the think tanks that have bought into this mindset are seeing that this isn't free market. These are state-sanctioned monopolies. They use heaps of public money. They cost too much. You know, the taxpayers are having to bail them out. There's no way that this user fee nonsense actually plays out in the real world, because a lot of times these pointy-headed think tanks in their policy world what they say will work in economic theory world is not the reality of economics in our country. Very few people have 75 cents a mile to pony up in addition to what they pay for gas tax, you know, and to fill their tank. To get to work every day. They're making it so that we can't even make a living. It's like taking a massive pay cut to pay that kind of money to simply walk
well,
into
and
work.
Well, and it's like you said, so, it's trying to sink us. And if, you know, this is, you know, it's ladies like you and Rosa that have really put a, given me a sign of hope that we can maybe do something against this steamrolling.
We really can.
Right. And you guys, I'm going to have to really bring it to a close here, but I want to thank you very much for coming together and doing this interview, because I really think you both are powerhouses that people need to hear more of, and so they can, and who put it into a context that they can understand. And I want to say thank you.
Well, I really appreciate
well, thank
it
you for having us.
Thank you very much. I want to encourage people to go to our website, which is DemocratsAgainstUNAgenda21.com, and also take a look at my book, which is Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. And also we're publishing a cartoon book, which is really great, called Cartoons Rejected by the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Cartooning. And that's just going to come out, that'll be out before the election. So check our website for that.
And Terry Hall, you have the San Antonio SAT or SATollParty.com site, right?
That's our first group that we started. That's right. It's a local group called SA Toll Party. It's supposed to be a spinoff or a play on words of the Boston Tea Party, basically a tax revolt. Mm-hmm. That was our local group, and it's SATollParty.com. But really, we went statewide in 2007, and the website that we keep up to date the most is our TexasTurf.org. That's Texas spelled out, T-U-R-F as in freedom, .org. And you can also check out TruthBetold.com. And again, that's T-O-L-L-E-D. And you can watch some of the documentary films about our cause and our issue and some of our victories. And really, you can see right in front of you the abuses of government. And some of this is the stuff they'll say in these open public hearings will literally make you drop your jaw and wonder what country you're living in when you see the absolute raw power that they exercise and the pure contempt that they have for the ordinary citizen. But we can and will continue to turn this around. The more people we educate, you know, the more chances we have of completely stomping on the UN Agenda 21 in our communities. And that's what it's going to take is one by one, local community after local community. And I would encourage you also to check out American Stewards of Liberty. I think it's stewards.us is their website. That is something that we have used to stop the Trans-Texas Corridor before we got it pulled out of statute. We had it, really the plug got pulled because we used something called local government coordination to force the state and the federal agencies to the table. And when you talked about all these regional plans that MPOs and these other entities have, well, there's something that does not allow a federal or state or any other entity to conflict, do anything that would conflict with a local regional plan, which is why it's so important for them to get their agenda in those local plans, because then you can't cross it, you can't violate it. Well, we've gone around and done an end run around that by having some of these local governments that see through this nonsense, that withdraw from ICLEI or what have you, that will use local government coordination and pass a regional plan that doesn't allow any vestige of UN Agenda 21. And then they actually have a legal means to throw off Agenda 21 from state and federal mandates. So I encourage people to look into that as well. But there's lots of ways we can stop this, but I do appreciate very much, Melody and Rosa, you've been a delight. I've heard about your organizations and applaud what you're doing as well. So thanks for having us.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you guys again. And thanks. Bye.